Good morning, members. I call the meeting of the Property Tax Division to order pursuant to Rule 10.01. The first order of business is that we need to take a roll call to determine who's present. The clerk, Mr. Peterson, will now take the roll.
Chair Joaquin?
Present.
Vice Chair Gomez?
Present.
Representative Hertas? Representative Hertas, I think you're on mute.
Thank you. Present.
Thank you. Representative Anderson?
Anderson, present.
Representative Becker-Finn?
Present.
Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Representative Green?
Present.
Representative Hassan? Representative Hassan? Representative Herr? Representative Herr? Representative Marquardt?
Present.
Representative Mortensen? Representative Mortensen? Representative Pulaski?
Pulaski, present.
Representative Torkelson?
Present.
Representative Hassan? Representative Herr? Representative Mortensen? That concludes the roll call, and there is a quorum, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Members, sorry about that. I want to note that all the committee documents for today have been sent to members and are in the committee packets on the House website. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for March 17th. Representative Gomez, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, and I'd like to move that we adopt the minutes for March 17th, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gomez. Does anyone have any questions about the minutes? Seeing none, although go ahead and unmute yourself. This will be a voice vote. All those in favor of approving the March 17th minutes, say aye.
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 All those opposed, no. The minutes are adopted. Members, we don't have any more official action before the committee today. We're going to save moving the bill and the amendments for Wednesday. So we're just going to briefly walk through the bill. I'm going to just do some opening comments, and we're going to be following along with the DE1 in the nonpartisan summary that have been in your packets. And then I'll kick it over to the House research staff to walk through the bill and the corresponding spreadsheet. Then we'll hear from those who have signed up to give brief testimony. And afterwards, we'll have some time for member questions. And actually, after nonpartisan staff walks through the bill, we'll have some time for clarifying questions, too, for nonpartisan staff. So first, I would like to express my gratitude to that nonpartisan staff for their work over the last week, putting the bill together in the division report, and for their guidance over the last few months as we've done our work in committee. We could not do our jobs as legislators without the tremendous work of the folks in House Research. I'd also like to thank Minority Lead Rep Hertas for your willingness to meet with me every week and go over the bills, and for your counsel. I appreciate your partnership. Members, I have just a few comments about the division report in front of you before I turn it over to nonpartisan staff for the walkthrough. In the DE1, you will find many of the provisions that we heard during the committee process. Your discussion around these bills has been helpful in pulling this report together. In the division report, we've made some changes related to the property tax exemptions, application dates, and a few other provisions in Article 1, some of which include Chair Marquardt's bill around increasing transparency in the local budget setting process, and Representative Becca Finn's legislation on fire service districts. In Article 2 and 3, we delve into a few special local taxes which encompass the wonderful world of local option sales tax. And early in session, as you remember, I sent out a memo on local option sales taxes that laid out its history and the more recent conversation regarding the parameters for this mechanism meant to fund local capital projects. I included some of those parameters that this division discussed over the last 2 years when the previous legislature altered the process in that memo. We then discussed the memo in committee and concluded that the project should be regional, involve expenditures on capital projects, and provide some sort of benefit to those not living in the city or county that would be paying the taxes. I've tried to stay true to those discussions when including members' bills in this division report. In Article 4, our bills regarding tax increment financing, TIF is an important tool in the toolbox for cities across our state and that spurs economic growth, especially for those cities that are fully developed. With this division report, we provide flexibility for individual cities as well as cities across the state when it comes to the five-year rule and the use of unencumbered TIF increment. We also have expanded TIF pooling rules to allow expenditures for affordable housing projects, that too across the state. Article 5 is Chair Marquardt's House File 500 and is the annual public financing bill. And finally, in Article 6, we tackle depreciation calculations, a study for property tax classified as 4D, and allow cities to establish tourism improvement districts. I'd like to close with thanking our committee administrator, Nathan Jessen, who I think was forgotten more about tax policy than I will ever know, our CLA, Eric Peterson, for keeping us all organized, our DFL House researcher, Sean Haydorn, GOP researchers, Stephen Rubis, and the new Republican researcher, Margaret Martin, all the work you do for your respective caucuses. And last but not least, the incredible House media for the long hours they put in to help us do our jobs in this virtual setting while making what we do accessible to the public. So with that, members, I would like to turn it over to House Research to walk through the different sections of the bill, and then Ms. Schill to go over the spreadsheet. And with that, I will turn it over, I believe, to Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair, members, Jared Swanson with House Research. I'm going to begin the walkthrough of the division report with Article 1, which is the property tax article. So Section 1 of Article 1 provides a property tax exemption for approximately 35 parcels owned by the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe in Cass County. Section 2 of Article 1 modifies the qualifying relatives list for ag relative homesteads so that this list matches the residential relative homestead qualifying relatives list. Sections 3, 6, and 16 all relate to a manufactured home park property class rate change. So these sections set the class rate at 0.75% for manufactured home park property and manufactured homes that are not classified under another provision. Section 6 makes one additional change related to 4D property. This change would set the first tier valuation limit at $174,000. For assessment years 2022 and 2023. Sections 4, 5, and 7 change the application deadline for applying for homestead. These sections would move the application deadline date to December 31st, and they also move the Disabled Veterans Homestead Market Value Exclusion application deadline to the 31st of December as well. Section 8 of Article 1 would require counties and cities with a population of at least 500 to publicly post budget information and hold public meetings on their proposed levies prior to certifying these levies. Section 9 of Article 1 removes the requirement that counties, cities with a population of at least 500, and school districts hold truth in taxation hearings. These hearings are replaced by the Minnesota Property Taxpayer Day hearings that are established in Section 11. Section 9 makes one additional change. This is to require fire protection special taxing districts, which are established in Section 13, to hold truth in taxation hearings as well. Section 10 of this article requires certain local taxing jurisdictions to include supplemental levy and budget information with their proposed property tax statements. Section 11 is the Minnesota Property Taxpayers Day. So this section just establishes a new public hearing date for counties, cities with a population of at least 500, and school districts. These hearings would all need to be held on the same day. And then each of these jurisdictions would hold these public meetings to discuss their budget and proposed levies. Sections 12 and 13 of Article 1 relate to fire protection special taxing districts. So these two sections just set up these districts and add the fire protection districts within the definition of entities that are special taxing districts. And finally, Sections 14 and 15 of Article 1 authorize a city to impose a special assessment for energy improvement projects. And Madam Chair, that concludes Article 1, and I can move on to Article 2. So Article 2 you can find on page 34 of the DE amendment, and this just has two sections that are both related to local government aid payment adjustments. So Section 1 of Article 2 provides additional local government aid payments to three cities for 5 years. So under this provision, the city of Floodwood would receive an additional $250,000 in LGA per year for 5 years. And the city of Staples and the city of Warren would both receive an additional $320,000 in LGA per year for 5 years. Section 2 of Article 2 increases the overall LGA appropriation for 5 years to cover those aid adjustments that were in the previous section. Once those aid adjustments have expired, the LGA appropriation would go back to the level that it's at under current law. And Madam Chair, that concludes Article 2. I believe Ms. Hagler will walk through Article 3 next.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. Go ahead, Ms. Hagler.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Article 3 contains all of the local sales tax provisions. Sections 1 and 2 make changes to existing special local taxes in the city of Plymouth and Sartell. And the only change that we heard in committee the only change from what we heard in committee is that the expiration date of the Plymouth local lodging tax is extended to a time determined by the city council when the amounts received from the tax are sufficient to pay any bonds issued for the project prior to January 1, 2022, instead of having the tax go on for an infinite amount of time. Sections 3 through 19 authorize new local sales taxes. And the following changes were made from the original bills. For the city of Edina, Section 5 authorizes the tax for two projects only, the Fred Richards and Braemar Park development projects. For the city of Hermantown, Section 8 authorizes the tax for two projects, the upgrades to the hockey arena and the construction of the Hermantown Proctor Trail. For the city of St. Cloud, Section 16 authorizes the tax for one project, which are the improvements to the athletic complex. And then for the city of Wade Park, Section 19 authorizes the tax for only two projects, the construction of a public safety facility and construction of regional trail connections. The remainder of the article for the cities of Wadena, St. Peter, Oakdale, Moorhead, Maple Grove, Little Falls, Litchfield, Grand Rapids, Fergus Falls and Cloquet, and then the counties of Itasca and Carlton, the provisions in this article are as they were heard in committee with the incorporation of any amendments that were adopted. And as Mr. Swanson indicated in his discussion of Article 2, some cities were granted extra LGA appropriations, and these were originally presented as local option sales tax. However, for the division report, they were converted into those extra LGA payments. And Madam Chair, that concludes Article 3, and I can move into Article 4. Article 4 contains the tax increment financing provisions. Section 1 through 4 contain the flexibility provisions from Representative Fisher's Bill 1736 and Representative Torkelson's Bill 1587, with only minor technical adjustments made at the suggestion of the State Auditor's Office when Mr. Noor testified in committee. These sections allow unencumbered increment to be transferred to a municipality's general fund or to a business that was affected by COVID-19. Section 2 allows for the transfer of increment to an affordable housing trust fund and expands the allowable amount of increment that a city can elect to use for affordable housing, increases from 10% to 25%. And then lastly, sections 3 and 4 extend the five-year rule to 10 years for all redevelopment districts certified in 2018 and on. And then section 4 makes a corresponding change to the six-year rule. Sections 5 through 15 are the city's specific TIF provisions that came before the committee for the cities of Bloomington, Burnsville, Fridley, Minnetonka, Mountain Lake, Richfield, St. Louis Park, Wayzata, and Windham. And there were no substantive changes from how they were heard in committee, but again, there were some technical adjustments made from the OSA's suggestion, and then any amendments that were adopted in committee were incorporated here. And Madam Chair, that concludes Article 4, and I can move on to Article 5. Article 5 contains the provision from House File 500, the public financing bill, and only non-substantive clarifications were made, as well as the incorporation of the amendment that was adopted in committee. And that, Madam Chair, concludes Article 5, and Mr. Swanson will close out with Article 6.
Thank you, Ms. Hagler. Mr. Swanson.
Madam Chair and members, Article 6 contains a number of miscellaneous tax provisions, and this article starts on page 75 of the DE amendment. Section 1 of Article 6 changes the depreciation calculation under Rule 8100 for wind and solar energy conversion systems placed into service or repowered after December 31st, 2019. This section also requires the Commissioner of Revenue to use the good cause exemption to incorporate this change into Rule 8100. Sections 2 and 3 of Article 6 both relate to property tax refunds. So Section 2 of the article increases the maximum homestead credit refund by $250 for claimants at most income levels. This increase in the maximum credit is lowered for each of the four highest income ranges that are eligible for the credit. And Section 3 of the article reduces the copay percentages for the renter's credit by 5 to 15%, depending on the income range of the applicant. Sections 4 through 13 of Article 6 are all related to the Tourism Improvement District Bill that we heard in committee. So these sections would allow counties, cities, and towns to establish tourism improvement districts. These districts could only be established by petition of the business owners paying a majority of the potential fees. The Tourism Improvement Association that would be responsible for managing the district would be made up of businesses that are subject to these fees. And finally, Section 14 of Article 6 requires the Commissioner of Revenue to produce a report on Class 4D property and 4D housing programs. The report must include information on 4D units and an analysis of the impact of reducing the classification rate for the first tier of 4D property to 0.25%. There were a few technical changes made to the study language based on some feedback from the Department of Revenue, but otherwise that study language is the same as what was heard in committee. And Madam Chair, that concludes Article 6.
Thank you, Mr. Swanson. And now we'll go on to Ms. Schell to look over the spreadsheet.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Kathy Schell, House Fiscal Staff. We have two spreadsheets that have been posted to the webpage, the first of which is an update for the February forecast, and that gives all of the budget activities for spending in the tax aids and credits area. And the update to the February forecast, those numbers are reflected on the second spreadsheet in the summary area where we have listed changes to the February forecast reflected in the delete all amendment. So starting on the second spreadsheet, which is a portrait presentation that shows the changes to the February forecast, I'll draw your attention to lines 1 through 3, which is the summary section. The February forecast in tax aids and credits spends a total of $4,164,181,000 in fiscal 22 and 23, and $4,306,710 in fiscals 24 and 25. The changes in total from the division, the division report DE, which is the delete all amendment, is listed on line 2, and I will present to you a small correction that should be in that line. The first in fiscal 22 spending is $35,000. In 2023, it should be $30,790,000 for a total of fiscal 22 and 23 of $30,825,000. In fiscal 24, the number should be $32,950,000. In fiscal 25, it should be $34,850,000 for a total change in the 24-25 biennium of $67,800,000. When you add the two together, you'll see the sum on line three, which is a total of fiscal 22 and 23, $4,195,006. And in fiscal 24-25, it should be $4,374,510,000. Now, there is one line with a change in it, but I will proceed through the spreadsheet. Lines 5 through 26 are property tax refund changes. And there are a number of bills listed here that have interactions as well as changes to the actual property tax refund. Lines 7 and 8 are Representative Joachim's bill, House File 1735, with the property tax refund changes. This is a little different than what we presented in committee. The difference is shown in line 8 with the homeowner property tax refund. There is an increase in the maximum refund of $250 per filer, and the impact of that is $13,900,000 in fiscal 23 and $15,800,000 in fiscal 24, $17,500,000 in fiscal 25. The renter's PTR, the reduction of copays between 5 and 15% is what you saw in committee. Moving down the spreadsheet, we see Representative Petersburg's bill with the homestead, relative agricultural homestead determination. There are two impacts here. That's exactly what you saw in committee. On lines 14 through 15, we have Representative Hertas manufactured home and home park classification. There's a PTR interaction that. The $250,000 per year is what we saw in committee as well. We have Representative Becker Finn's bill, which had this is the tribal owned property for 35 properties in Cass County. There are two impacts here. This is what we saw in committee. The state general levy refund is only in fiscal 22. The property tax refund interaction is $10,000 for fiscal 23, 24, and 25. Moving down the spreadsheet, lines 21 through 23, we have Representative Detmer's bill that extended the deadlines for homestead-related filers. The property tax interaction there, first of all, the homestead extension to December 31st is $70,000 in fiscal 23 and a negligible impact in 24 and 25. And then we have the veterans market value exclusion impact, negative $30,000 in fiscal 23 and a negative negligible impact in the tails. Line 25 is Representative Howard's bill there for modifying the 4D housing. This is different than what we had in committee. We are freezing the index for a two-year time period, and that's in conjunction with actually performing the study, which is further on down the spreadsheet. The two-year freeze has an impact in the tails of $40,000 in fiscal 24 and $50,000 in fiscal 25. Representative Carlson's bill, 1843, is on line 26 with wind energy and solar energy production tax. The fiscal impact is in the tails of $160,000 per year. That is what you saw in committee. And then we move to lines 29 through 34. These are the changes in aids and credits that were first presented as local option sales taxes, as Ms. Hagler mentioned. These are all reflected in Article 2, and you'll see Representative Sandstein's bill for the city of Floodwood, $250,000 in each fiscal 23, 24, and 25. The city of Staples, $320,000 in each fiscal 23, 24, and 25. And then this is where the correction is in line 33. There was a discrepancy between this spreadsheet and the bill, and the update should reflect $320,000 for the city of Warren in each fiscal 23, 24, and 25. And I'll point out that each of these three items will have an impact beyond what is shown in the spreadsheet, which is the forecast window. It will continue through pay 26 for each of those items. Finally, on line 37, you'll see the 4D housing study, House File 1298. There's a fiscal impact. This was reflected it was the cost of the previous 4D study at $15,000. It's placed in fiscal 22. So you'll see on line 39, the total of these changes in fiscal 22, $35,000. In fiscal 23, $30,790 for a total of $30,825. In fiscal 24, the total should be $32,950. For fiscal 25, $34,850 for a total of $67,800,000. Now the rest of the spreadsheet, lines 40 through 78, are all changes with no state fund impact. Lines 40 through 45 are showing property tax changes that are of miscellaneous nature. 46 through 57, tax increment financing, 58 through 60, local lodging and the food and beverage taxes, and then 61 through 78 are the local option sales taxes. Madam Chair, that concludes the presentation of the spreadsheet. If there are any questions, I'm ready for them. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Michelle. Members, we're going to move on next to public testimony, but before we do that, I wanted to see if anybody had any questions, clarifying questions for nonpartisan staff right now. We'll be here at the end too, if you think of something. I will wait just a minute. Members, any clarifying questions? All right, with that, we are going to move on to public testimony. First up, I have Ms. Fishman from the Department of Revenue. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Joachim and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. My name is Tracy Fishman, and I am an Assistant Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Governor Waltz prioritizes those who have been hit hardest by the COVID-19 pandemic, that is working families, small businesses, and students. These priorities are reflected in the revised tax and budget proposal he and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan put forward last Thursday. And some of these priorities are shared in the division report your committee has put forward today. First, I would like to thank you, Chair Joachim, for including expansions to the homestead property tax refund and the renter's credit in your proposal. The governor's revised budget included an expansion to the renter's credit. We know this has been a particularly challenging time for families. The renter's credit refunds target low-income households and those on fixed incomes, and is an important program for helping to reduce the cost of housing and shore up taxpayers' ability to meet basic needs. The governor's proposal included additional provisions to expand eligibility for property tax refunds, and we are committed to working together to address the hardships that too many Minnesotans are facing. I also want to thank you for prioritizing local governments in this bill. There are many provisions that will help local governments address their unique needs, whether it be fire service or infrastructure. The governor did not include any of these provisions in his revised budget, but values the strong relationships the state has with our local government partners. The department's policy and technical bill was shared and heard in the full tax committee and included some provisions for property tax administration. While they are smaller provisions, they will still help many taxpayers. We hope they will advance as the bill moves forward throughout the process. I also want to share that the department has administrative and policy concerns about some provisions in this bill, including the provision that changes the depreciation calculation for wind and solar energy conversion systems. We look forward to working with the author and stakeholders to address these concerns. Also, in regards to the 4D Affordable Housing Programs report, we will be confirming with our agency partners that we will have access to all of the information required to complete this report as directed. Chair Joachim and members of the committee, we look forward to working with you and the tax committees in the coming weeks to ensure a fair and equitable tax bill for all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fishman. Next, we have Mr. Carlson. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Gary Carlson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, an organization of 835 cities from across the state. The League submitted a letter for the committee consideration, and I don't plan to go through that letter in any great detail, but I do want to express our appreciation and support for the Fire Protection District framework language, the 4D property class study, the TIF flexibility provisions, and also the direct taxpayer relief provided through the expansion of the Homestead Credit Refund and the Renters Refund programs. We support all of those provisions. I would like to share some additional thoughts on revisions to the tax hearing and notification changes that are included in the draft. Over the weekend, I circulated the language to cities throughout the state, and I received a number of responses. I'm still receiving those responses even as of this morning. We understand the intent of that language. It's a laudable intent for having more citizen involvement and participation in the local budget process. That said, I want to remind the committee that Minnesota really does an exceptional job of informing citizens about local property tax decisions already. Few other states have a process as comprehensive as Minnesota's tax hearing and notification law, also called Truth in Taxation. We set a preliminary budget by September 30th. We send out notices to taxpayers, essentially a second tax bill or an estimated tax bill, that shows the maximum tax burden that a citizen would have to pay. So we do a lot already in the system. And on top of that, even outside of that specific process, we have lots of hearings at the local level that involve citizens all the time. And cities do that in their own creative ways. As many of you know, you because you've served on city councils or as mayors, you may know that sometimes city council members actually perhaps get blamed for maybe more than they should. I remember a story from a council member from Northfield a number of years ago when I first started working around the Capitol in the early 1980s, who told me that in Northfield, she would get regular calls from residents about their state and federal taxes. So in many ways, local officials are viewed as really the contact for all of government and frequently are perhaps even more accountable for all levels of government. We know that in-person attendance at hearings has not been as strong in some areas of the state. Our policy committees at the League of Minnesota Cities have discussed bringing forward proposals to relax the current process, but we've decided not to do that over the years. The committees have agreed that the process does afford citizens the opportunity to participate and understand the processes to develop those budgets. And in many cities, we have to remember, have broadcast techniques, media coverage, and other online participation that may occur remotely, already through the current law process. Again, cities have developed their own information sharing techniques, and citizens have come to understand and expect those sources of information. And we don't want to overwhelm our taxpayers with perhaps too much information. If I could just briefly leave the committee with a couple of comments that came in from some of our city members. This one was from a city of a population of about 5,400 in Western Minnesota, basically saying, we don't have an IT personnel to facilitate the online meetings. My city council is remote now and I am the person running the Zoom meetings. Cities just simply are not production companies. And then a city just outside the metro area, population 18,000, our local elected officials take their responsibilities very seriously and are very open and transparent about the process. They publish their draft budgets, take public input, notify all taxpayers through the current truth and taxation process. Adding another unfunded mandate and committee requirement for cities implies that our local officials are just not doing their job, which is not true. And then finally, a city of 1,500 population just west of the metro, the mayor wrote me and said, the requirement for all jurisdictions to hold truth and taxation hearings on a specified date at an hour interval for each entity would effectively limit citizen participation and input in the process, especially if citizens had questions on each portion of the tax bill. It would, in most cases, be physically impossible to attend all, and even if attendance was remote, it would be difficult for one person to have input into each hearing. In summary, Madam Chair and members, we support the current truth and taxation process, and we will always look for ways to enhance participation, but we do have concerns that a one-size-fits-all mandate will not always produce the best participation results. Thank you, and I will stay in the meeting for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Next up, we have Mayor Miller. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Rick Miller, and I am the mayor of the city of Wake Park. Wake Park is a small but growing city just west of St. Cloud with a population of more than 7,700. On behalf of Wake Park, I want to express our gratitude to the committee for including two of the three projects we had proposed along with the local option sales tax of 0.5%. Their division report. The regional trail connections and improved police facilities are necessary and important to our community's growth. And we look forward to the results of the next general election. That being said, we are disappointed that our 10th Avenue Regional Corridor project is not currently included as a project to go before the voters. As we testified earlier to the committee, this project is critical to our growth and expansion as a regional resource to surrounding communities. And we respectfully ask the committee to include this project in our request going forward. We are confused as why this project is not yet included. We followed very closely the proceedings of the 2019 omnibus tax bill, in which several local option sales tax proposals with local transportation projects were granted legislative approval. We also noted closely the changes to the statute around local sales tax provisions and have spent the past 2 years refining our proposal to comply with 2019 changes. Our 10th Avenue Corridor project is clearly regional in nature and meets the remainder of the requirements in the statute, and we have absolutely no restriction of transportation. There are no restrictions of the transportation projects in the statute. We stand ready with city staff to work with you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the committee in the coming days to find a solution for our city. Without enacting the local tax for this project, we see no viable way to fund it, and that will simply continue to suppress our growth. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. And again, we are ready to work quickly to find a resolve.
Thank you, Mayor Miller. Mr. Vandearty, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Charlie Vandearty for Metro Cities, which represents the collective interests of cities across the 7-county metropolitan region. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments today. We thank the committee for including the 4D study and reporting language in Article 6, Section 14 of the division report. Metro City supports the current 4D low-income rental classification. The study and report, authored by Representative Herr, will provide policymakers the data to assess the impact of a 4D expansion before that change is made to a 4D classification. The study is targeted to gather more information on local impacts and understand more specifically how changing the program will impact each city's property tax base. We are continuing to discuss the provisions in House File 496 included in the report with our member cities. We support transparency in the truth and taxation process and have heard similar concerns, as Mr. Carlson mentioned, in the one-size-fits-all mandate, and will continue to work with Chair Marquardt and the committee as the bill moves forward. With respect to the local sales tax authorizations, Metro Cities does not take a position on individual city bills, but generally supports the ability of cities to diversify tax bases. Metro Cities also supports the homestead and renter's credit provisions. Finally, Madam Chair, we thank the committee for including the tax increment financing flexibility in Article 4, Sections 1 through 4, and carried by Representative Fisher. That provides several important changes to TIF statute that will help cities address affordable housing needs that are important to their communities. We thank the committee for their consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Vandarardi. And I have to apologize. I should have said this much earlier. Representative Herr has joined the committee. And then we also, there's members, I don't know if these were included in electronic packets yet. If they weren't, I apologize. We'll get them out as soon as possible. There are letters received from the Minnesota Realtors, the Bankers Association, and the Minnesota Budget Project. I guess the letters were included in your electronic packet. Sorry about that, and posted as well to the website. Next up, we have Mr. Qualis. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Tony Quillis, and I'm going to wear a couple hats this morning. I'm going to be representing Hospitality Minnesota, as well as the Minnesota Association of Convention and Visitors Bureau. Madam Chair, I'd like to address my comments to Article 3, Section 1, which is dealing with the sunset date of the Plymouth Lodging Tax. Madam Chair, when this was originally proposed, we objected to it because one industry, the lodging industry, is going to be paying for capital improvements such as repaving of trails and the updating of a band shell in the city of Plymouth. The legislature put a 10-year sunset on that, and as Ms. Hagler pointed out, originally was removed in House File 551. Now, the language in Article 3, Section 1 is better, but is still concerning, Madam Chair, because it is tied to the amount of bonds that will be issued and the lodging tax collected to retire those bonds. Madam Chair, depending on the size of the bond request by the city, and then the lodging tax, which obviously is one of the hardest industries that's been hit in the last year, if that continues to be slow for the next year or two, this lodging tax could go on for 10, 20, 30 years, Madam Chair, and that's very concerning to Hospitality Minnesota, as well as the Visitors and Convention Bureau. So, Madam Chair, I will also stick around for questions, and thank you for allowing me to voice our concerns to Article 3, Section 1 this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Quillis. Next up, we have Ms. Gustin. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Joachim, members of the division. My name is Tiffany Gustin, and I am the Associate Director of Management and Insurance Trust Services for the Minnesota School Boards Association. But before starting with MSBA, I served as the business manager of the Aiken Public Schools. And during my 10 years in that position, I was an active member of the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, or MASBO. And thank you for allowing me to represent both MSBA and MASBO with my testimony this morning. I would like to say just a few words related to the Minnesota Property Taxpayers Day, which can be found in Article 1, Section 11. First of all, I would like to thank Representative Marquardt, who met with me along with two other school business officials to discuss the proposed language that relates to school district budget hearings. We had great discussion around our concerns, which really can be summarized as with regard to having timelines. The language requires school districts to present budget information for the following fiscal year, as can be found on line 26.6. While these proposed budget hearing timelines work very well for cities and counties who have a calendar year fiscal, the start of a school district's fiscal year is July 1st. So preparing an accurate subsequent year budget in December would be extremely challenging, as many of the budget drivers remain uncertain. For example, enrollment is one of the largest drivers of school district revenue. And to prepare a budget for the following fiscal year, school districts would need to estimate enrollment 10 months prior to the start of the school year. In odd number years, like we're in right now, the general education aid formula amount is set for the upcoming biennium. And with the proposed language, a school district would have to project this revenue, which can represent in excess of 60% of its total district revenue, a month before the legislative session even starts, or approximately 5 months before the session is scheduled to adjourn. On the expense side, again, with enrollment numbers being uncertain, staffing levels are uncertain. And because school district staffing levels drive expenses, because like other organizations, between 65 and 75% of expenses are attributed to wages and benefits. While presenting this information in December would be challenging, line 24.1 further tightens the timeline as it requires proposed budget information for that subsequent year to be included as a supplement with the proposed tax statements, which must be mailed by the county between November 10th and November 24th. For this mailing, any November referendum elections wouldn't have canvassed election results before the financial impacts would need to be provided for publication. The mailing also requires information that is published according to Statute 123B10. However, for many schools, this information is not available until the end of November, which fits the December meeting timelines, but not the publication requirements for that supplement. So to summarize, school district budget development does not begin in earnest until after January 1st, and it must be completed by the end of June. And providing estimates before the process truly begins risks the very transparency that is being sought through the language. I would also like to comment briefly on the meeting start times, and I would echo some of the concerns that were expressed by Mr. Carlson on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities. But further, we are concerned about a start time of 8 p.m. for school districts, which is the jurisdiction that most closely serves families with young children. In addition to the start time, having a hard limit of 20 minutes to present the levy and budget information may prevent the taxing jurisdictions from adequately informing the public about the levy and budget comparisons. So in summary, school districts appreciate and support Representative Marquardt's desire for transparency and communication with taxpayers. And MASBO members, as well as MSBA, are very open to continuing to have dialogue, to work together, to revise the language in order to accomplish the goals of the language, in order to provide accurate information and encourage public public participation in the process. Thank you so much for your time this morning, and I will stand for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Gustin. Ms. Kiernan, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Grania McKiernan, and I'm with Xcel Energy. Xcel Energy is the largest property taxpayer in the state at $210 million this year, and that's passed directly through to customers on their monthly electric bills. So we appreciate your including the provision in Article 6, Section 1 that addresses an unintended effect of the utility property valuation rule. The adjustment being made here will ensure that the thousands of megawatts of new wind and solar we're adding to our system won't be inadvertently taxed as personal property. We look forward to working with the department on this provision, and thank you for allowing us to testify.
Thank you, Ms. McKiernan. Members, I don't believe that we have any other folks signed up for public testimony, so I want to open it up for questions. I hope the testifiers do stick on in case members have questions for the testifiers. With that, I'm going to kick it open to members on the committee. And we have Representative Hertas.
Good morning, and thank you, Madam Chair. As you know, you and I have worked well together during the course of this session and having weekly meetings and talking about different things that emerge. And you and I had a discussion last night about today's meeting. And I had a little bit of time to think a little bit about maybe Article 5 and some of the public finance section. And just a couple things that we might want to think about a little bit as we move to Wednesday. With regard to the public finance or assessment procedure for energy improvements, and I suppose you could even include sprinkler improvements in this, there is an issue that, you know, I guess if I were a banker or a lender and I have a first mortgage on a property, this provision would allow government's authority through assessment to kind of take priority over that first mortgage, and it could change the loan to value ratios that maybe somebody was qualified under. So that might be a little bit of a concern with regard to ensuring that the loan will be repaid in full if there would be a default. Secondly, would be the possibility that this could have an effect, particularly in rental property, could potentially raise rent a little bit, maybe not significant, but it could be a factor that would do that. And I guess maybe the last thing would be whether or not there should maybe be a dollar limit as to how much could be assessed, or maybe a percent of the property value, some type of limitation there. I suppose I could maybe see a rental property or a commercial property that wanted to do energy improvements that could be quite expensive, but maybe the municipality or a small town that it might be located in might have limited ability in terms of its capacity to take on public finance projects. So since we talked last night, I had a chance to sleep on this and think about it a little bit, and that might be something we might want to have a discussion on Wednesday. Those are my comments on that.
Thank you, Representative Hirsch. As you mentioned at the beginning, sorry, you were cutting out a little bit, that you had some questions around Article 5. Were there any specific ones? That's just the public financing
article. I may have misquoted that article, but I was specifically speaking to the ability of being able to assess crop energy improvements. I glanced at that as public finance, so.
Thank you, Representative Cortez, because the one I could talk to you about, the other, I'd have to kick it over to nonpartisan staff.
All right, thank you.
So thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, and good morning, Madam Chair. I'd like a little further explanation from one of the researchers, if possible, on Article 3, the provision where the three cities had come asking for a local option sales tax, and we've evidently changed that to additional LGA payments. And my question or concern would be, if they get additional funding, would that affect the payments going out to all the other cities in the state of Minnesota?
Thank you, Representative Anderson. I can actually answer that one. That's why we bumped up the LGA number for the 5 years that we're paying out on those. So it won't affect anybody else's LGA, number one. Number two, the reason why I looked at this is after hearing the presentations from those three cities in committee and realizing what a strain this was going to put on their tax base, that and how long it would take them to actually raise that money for very small projects, it just seemed to make more sense to help them out by changing it to LGA rather than having a 30-year tax on a $2 million project. So that's why I did it. But I don't know, was there anything else that nonpartisan staff could add for you?
No, that answers my question, Madam Chair. And just wondering if that has been done in the past or if this is something new that the committee is doing.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. I know it has, at least for my city in Hopkins with our arts center, but I will kick that over to nonpartisan staff to maybe talk about some other times that it's happened. Who would like to answer that one?
Madam Chair, Kathy Schull, House Fiscal. Yes, we have done this in the past. I could provide that more detailed information probably offline with Representative Anderson if that would be helpful. But yes, we actually most recently in the 2019 division report, we did this. Some of it as it moved forward through the omnibus tax bill was changed. But yes, we have done this before.
Representative Anderson, is it okay for Ms. Schill to get you that information offline?
Yeah, I'd appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Members.
And Madam Chair, I think we did that
for Hermantown. Thank you, Representative. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yes.
I think we did that for Hermantown in the last biennium.
Thank you, Representative Hirtaz. Yeah, there's a few. In fact, you can see some of them if you look in the language right below that second section of Article 2. You'll see some of the ones that we cross out that we, you know, just cleaning up language to that are done. Members, any further questions? While people are thinking, I just wanted to add, there is some cleanup language that we're going to be doing in an author's amendment on Wednesday. There's some of these bills that folks are still trying to find some, how do you say, peace in the valley, which is a phrase that I haven't heard for a while. And so there'll be some adjustments in an author's amendment on Wednesday. We don't have a 24-hour rule here in property taxes, but I want to make sure that I get the author's amendment posted within 24 hours so people have time for the discussion. And I'd appreciate if folks are considering that too and considering staff time to try to get them any changes you want to do as early as possible. And so that we can get it posted, because that gives it a chance, that gives a chance for those in the public to see that, see those changes that you're requesting in your amendments and have that discussion. That's why we worked hard to get the division report posted early on Friday so people would have time to look at it while we're rolling through it, and then also to rolling it out today and then having time today, tomorrow, for folks to look at before we bring it before the committee on Wednesday. On Wednesday, we'll see if there's any other public testimony, if somebody's come forward, and then we will go to the author's amendment and then any other amendments that we could have. So, members, any other questions? This could definitely be a record at how fast a property tax division report was talked about. I hope that is a good sign. Seeing no further member questions, with that, we will be meeting on Wednesday at our normal time period at 3:00. And with that, we are adjourned.